Michael Rourke edged forward, the dunes having given way to temple ruins he judged were millennia old. Cracked, jagged columns thrust skyward. The crumbled remains of their caps littered the sand-swept stones of the flooring beneath his feet. He worked his way ahead, one column at a time. Hammerschmidt took the lead on the opposite side of the ancient walkway. One of Hammerschmidt's enlisted men dogged Hammerschmidt a column behind. The other did the same behind Michael. Michael crossed to the next column, the twin Beretta 92SBF 9mm military pistols in his fists, the safeties up into the fire position. Michael peered from behind the column. Karamazov's perimeter security was arranged oddly. The only means of penetrating the site of the dig, the only means that immediately presented itself at least, was through the temple corridor. Guards were stationed at the far end, their Animov 60 assault rifles held leisurely enough, but at the ready all the same. Four guards, it translated to one each for Michael, Hammerschmidt, and the two enlisted men, Hammerschmidt's commandos. Michael looked beyond the guards to the excavation site. No careful archaeological dig here. Earth movers gulped huge amounts of sand, then disgorged the sand into heaps between the temple from which Michael observed and the pit they dug. Perhaps a supply of nuclear weapons were hidden, perhaps something worse. But it might be the chance to kill Karamazov, and at the very least, to confound the hero marshal's plans. He thought at times, since the death of his wife, what he would say to his father, if his father, in fact, still did not know.
Dad, Madison, my wife, is dead. Your grandchild will never be born.
He thought of saying it that way, of saying it dozens of other ways. But he wanted, for his own sanity and the sanity of his father, to add one thing more.
I killed Karamazov.
A half dozen columns remained to separate Michael and Hammerschmidt across from him from the four guards at the end of the temple walkway. The guards stood in the shade, their black uniforms, black dress utilities, looking insufferably hot here. Michael glanced across the aisle to Hammerschmidt. Hammerschmidt nodded as Michael worked down the ambidextrous safeties of the pistols, then one at a time holstered them beneath his arms in the folds of the jalaba. As his right hand re-emerged, he held the life support system 2 knife at the ready. Another glance at Hammerschmidt, and Michael stepped into the walkway, edging quickly forward now, but careful of his footing lest he twist an ankle on the rough surface, lest he dislodge a chunk of paving and make a betraying noise. From the corner of his left eye, he could see Hammerschmidt moving forward too, one of the German bayonets in his left fist, a fighting knife of smaller proportions than the knife Michael held, clenched tight in his other hand. His enlisted shadow shifted on the sand behind him, 4 against 4, but silently. Michael moved ahead, taking long stride steps, making certain of the footing with each movement. He had to refocus his thoughts. He was thinking of the man who would be his target and who would somehow betray him. Why, he did not know. He thought of Madison, and his stomach tightened, his throat tightened. Hatred for these men who killed, who assaulted the innocent. Michael kept edging forward, the knife held at chest level, lest somehow the movement, the rustle of the fabric of his jalaba alert the guards. 6 feet to go. Michael nodded, raising the knife. He focused his concentration on the knife rather than the man, a design unchanged in 5 centuries, a faithful duplicate of the handmade original. He wondered if his father knew Jack Grain. A man who made a knife like this sounded like the kind of man his father would have counted a friend. With 3 feet between them, Michael took one long step, his left hand like a claw, swinging across the body plane of the guard on the far right, over the throat. Catching him before he fell, Michael dragged the dead guard into the deeper shade of the temple. For the first time, he glanced to his left. Hammerschmidt and his two enlisted men had claimed their targets as well. Michael wiped the blade of his knife clean against the Soviet guard's black BDU blouse and resheathed it. He then pulled the Beretta pistols from the leather. He approached the edge of the temple where the guards had stood. The two enlisted men were propping up the guards against the temple columns near to where they had originally stood, using long pieces of rigid steel cable coils slipped down the rear of the dead men's uniforms. From a distance, he supposed the appearance that the dead men stood under their own power would be satisfactory. Michael scanned the approximate quarter mile of desert that separated him from the dig site. It was imperative to know exactly when the Russians freed whatever they searched for from the sands. He glanced behind him. The pneumatic-powered rappelling rope launcher had fired. He looked back to the desert. There was no sign the sound had been heard. He could see Karamazov, strutting near the equipment that was doing the digging. Near, but not too near. Other officers appeared to be guarding Karamazov, shielding him. Had he his father's Steyr-Mannlicher SSG, he could have killed Karamazov. Had he his father's eye, he could have taken Karamazov with one of the iron-sighted German assault rifles. But he had neither the sniper rifle nor his father's peculiar gift. He considered himself as good as his father with a handgun, albeit not as experienced. He doubted anyone was quite as good a rifleman. His father seemed to be able to turn off impatience, turn off anger, and focus total concentration to the task. Michael strove for this, but had not yet attained it. He smiled at the thought. But being a Rourke, he had the confidence that someday he would. Michael looked back into the temple. One of the two enlisted men was already rappelling up a column. Field binoculars hung behind his back. The second enlisted man held the first man's rifle. Hammerschmidt edged toward Michael.
So far, so good, I believe the expression is.
Yes, so far, so good.
Perhaps then you shall have your revenge today, or Karamazov's secret.
Or both. But you're probably right, one or the other. The secret is probably the more important.
You're a good man to work beside, Herr Rourke.
Michael.
Otto.
You too, Otto.
Hammerschmidt and Michael Rourke turned as one. Michael shielded his eyes from the searing sun above them, beyond the shadows of the columns. The enlisted man was in place. Hammerschmidt held the listening piece of his radio to his ear.
The digging is nearly complete, my corporal thinks. He is an intelligent man and has keen powers of observation. He is likely correct.
Any idea
what? Wait. He tells me that there is a large cylinder of the type used for the underground storage of gasoline. It seems to be of stainless steel or titanium. It is completely untarnished and appears unscratched from the abrasiveness of the sand. It is almost mirror bright. They are moving in a helicopter with a crane. There, to the west.
Michael raised his own binoculars to his eyes and pushed the button for automatic focusing. A shape like a huge skeletal insect grew out of the horizon.
Herr Captain!
Michael looked to the man, as did Hammerschmidt. The young private held a radio headset to his ear, the radio itself strapped to his back.
Herr Captain, I have been monitoring the Soviet transmissions as you requested. Marshal Karamazov himself is directing the recovery operation. He is cautioning the crew of the helicopter that utmost care must be taken. He is ordering all his personnel to fall back, except those in the final recovery detail. I heard a reference, Herr Captain, to protective clothing.
Gas?
Maybe. Maybe worse.
Michael nodded, seeing Karamazov and his people fall back at a rapid jog toward their vehicles. Men in protective clothing, their purpose not certain, rushed toward the canister.
We have no protective clothing. I advise we withdraw to a safer distance. We should perhaps rethink attempting to steal Marshal Karamazov's prize. You would agree?
If we don't know what we're handling. Wait.
Michael shifted the binoculars quickly, focusing on a dark shape beneath the helicopter, farther away on the horizon. It was a truck, a cloud of dust behind it, almost surrounding it, but a truck of immense proportions.
Take a look at that.
Himo, that is huge. For a canister?
Get your men up top to take a look.
He estimates the size as 100 meters in length. It appears to have 8 axles and triple tires on each side of each axle.
A truck specially built to haul that thing he dug up, whatever it is.
Wait, there is more, Michael.
Michael Rourke watched Hammerschmidt's blue eyes as they focused into pinpoints of light.
We cannot be certain, but the suspension seems to be massive.
Do they have an aircraft that could haul that tank in the truck?
It would seem possible. Lieutenant Schmidt told me that their airfield is substantially larger than he would have thought necessary.
What is it? Where are they taking it? Shit!
There is a way to find out, I think. My man up above, he says there are men hanging to the sides of the truck on catwalks. 2 men on each side. They wear protective clothing. It includes some type of headgear that covers their face.
You might wind up following it back to Russia.
The underground city. Then all the better, huh, Michael?
Michael Rourke focused on the truck. He could see the men now, too. The two on the truck's right side looked the right size for himself and Hammerschmidt.
Why not?
In the final analysis, with Madison and the baby gone, he had little to lose. Jay knew the ground here like an animal would know a trail through the woods. Rourke observed the boy moving effortlessly along the rocky escarpment, climbing goat-like. But Jay would not know what a goat was, or an animal. The only animals he would know of were people. There was more animalistic behavior in some of the people the boy knew anyway than in anything wild, Rourke thought. Rourke discussed with Natalia the likelihood that the names Jay provided, Jay's own, and that of the bullying barrel-chested Char, were corruptions of actual names passed down through the years since Jay and the people like him were forced to survive upon the surface. That it was a survival experiment which had gone wrong was obvious. John Rourke looked forward to examining Jay and others of his people. It was evident that they had returned to the surface when background radiation was still hot enough to affect them. The leathery-looking skin, the odd color of Jay's eyes, were human, but not usual. Char, too, had those same eyes. As they moved, Rourke's own eyes assessed the young man, a slightly abnormal flare to the ears, again something shared with the bear-like Char. The cheekbones were large beyond normal, and the nostrils widely flared. Yet all the human qualities seemed to be there. Kinship, aggression, fear, and above all, the desire to know. Jay raised both hands, as though surrendering to some unseen enemy, but Rourke judged it a gesture signaling a halt. Natalia approached closer to the young man. Rourke passed them both, dropping into a crouch, cautiously going along the tongue of rock that extended ahead of them. He scanned side to side for evidence that indeed they had reached the mysterious Soviet staging area. Rourke stopped short, drawing back.
Jay tells me we have arrived.
He's a master of understatement. Look, and keep Jay back.
Rourke dropped to a prone position and started ahead through the snow along the tongue of rock. Natalia scrabbled up beside him. It was a perfect vantage point. Below, Soviet tanks of the type seen in the battle in Argentina, ranked six abreast, stretched nearly as far as the eye could see. Helicopter gunships and APCs like the one they followed stood in abundance. Troops were camped everywhere in tents like those he and Natalia saw earlier when the Soviet patrol they followed encamped for the night. Quonset huts made up the more permanent dwellings of the encampment. It was an army more massive than Rourke had seen since the time so long ago when Soviet tanks crossing the Khyber Pass, the event that began it all, changed his life, the lives of the people he loved, and the life of the planet. John Rourke doubted the Germans could field such a force while still retaining even nominal security at their complex in Argentina. The lines of supply would be difficult, almost impossible, unless some lightning strike could take the Russians out.
John! Over there! I saw something!
Rourke glanced to Natalia, then across the gulf separating the tongue of rock from the rock wall opposite them. He judged the distance as 1,000 yards or better, but he saw movement under the gray sun.
Damn! Get Jay down! A sniper!
Rourke pushed Natalia flat into the snow. He shrugged the SSG off his shoulder, then shifted it forward. He checked the scope setting, 3-power, as he cheeked to the green synthetic stock.
A silencer?
Gotta be a closed breech weapon. A single shot. That's why it's taking him so long to reload. Get Jay down and out of here. Back the way we came. I'll be with you.
Rourke gradually started increasing magnification, trying to acquire the sniper.
Go on!
No, he'll have a radio!
He'll have a radio, but he won't have time to use it yet. Maybe. There'll be Soviet troops up here fast, one way or the other. But they won't pinpoint us 100% till I open up. Now get out of here!
But 1,000 meters or better, John, is a tough shot!
It shouldn't be too bad a shot with this. I got him. Run for it!
Rourke blocked Natalia Anastasia Temerovna from his consciousness now, moving the scope only slightly so at full magnification he wouldn't lose the Soviet sniper. There wasn't a clear shot yet. The man would have to profile himself just a little bit more on the wall of rock to get into a perfect shooting position. He saw movement. What could only be a right shoulder and a dark shape taped or painted with irregular white patterns being brought to the shoulder. The head. John Rourke saw the head. He chambered one of the .308 boat tail rounds. The sniper's head was now visible. His right first finger snapped off the rearmost of the double triggers, setting the first for a pull that was barely a nudge. The sniper's gun would fire soon, but John Rourke couldn't move, lest he lose his shot. His right first finger brushed against the forward trigger. The snow pelted against the exposed skin of his left cheek. He realized he had removed the toque without thinking. The sniper's body seemed frozen for an instant. Rourke set the scope again. The man's eyes lost in distance, but something about the set of the bone structure beneath the white toque, which covered the man's face, and then redness where the white had been a fraction of a second earlier. The body lurched forward, rolling, slipping, billowing clouds of snow giving way around it, and it was gone, sailing down in the air. Rourke rolled onto his back. Despite the snowshoes, he started running. It wasn't a job for a knife, Hammerschmidt had said, and Michael Rourke agreed. The wire commando saw would make a perfect garrote, but would cut through fabric and flesh and achieve the same negative result as a knife. Michael Rourke early on developed a fondness for history. He showed Otto Hammerschmidt how to utilize the material of the keffiyehs they both wore as a scarf and a thuggy knot. The monstrously large truck stopped as the cargo helicopter's crane lifted the massive and gleaming cylinder from the trench in the sand. All eyes in the area of the excavation site seemed to be turned skyward. Michael broke from the cover of the nearer of the sand mounds built by the earth-moving equipment, the mound nearer the partially destroyed temple where they hid. He ran, a long-strided, low-loping run, stripped of his gear save for the double shoulder rig, the spare magazines for the Berettas, and his fighting knife. The improvised thuggy scarf was wound in both his tight-clenched fists. The two men on the truck's catwalk nearest him were enwrapped with the precarious swinging of the massive cylinder at the end of the helicopter's crane, nearly directly overhead now. It was 8 feet to the catwalk from the desert floor. Michael glanced left. Hammerschmidt was about a half stride behind him. Michael jumped and grabbed hold of the catwalk. He hurtled his weight across the catwalk, nearly knocking the decontamination-suited man into the cylindrically shaped basin in the truck bed. He looped the scarf about the man's throat as the man started to turn. But with a technique his father had taught him, Michael turned first, a full 180 degrees. And he flipped the man backward over his left shoulder and down from the catwalk to the sand. There was suddenly a blur of silver, the second man in decontamination gear. Michael jumped to the sand, onto the back of the first man, hammering his right fist against the neck that logic already told him was broken. But he had to make sure. The body didn't move. Michael's eyes scanned the area around them, but there was no alarm. Overhead, if the helicopter's cable snapped, the truck would be crushed, and so would he and Hammerschmidt. Already, Michael was unbuckling the fasteners for the decontamination suit. The man's eyes beneath the masked headgear were open wide in a mixture of death and astonishment. Michael pulled the headgear free of the decontamination suit, a coverall fitted with a backpack with double cylinders. He presumed the tanks contained some sort of oxygen mixture. He had the suit nearly stripped away now, praying silently that it would fit, not only well enough to appear normal, but be large enough to conceal the few weapons he brought. He had the man out of the suit now. The corpse was clothed in loose-fitting, thin black coveralls. He left these, no time anyway. He started into the decontamination suit. There was no need to remove his own boots. The dead man's boots were similar, and the decontamination suit's trouser legs were closed at the bottom to cover footgear. He pulled into the reflective upper portion of the suit. The breathing unit, one piece with the suit, apparently served a cooling function as well. It covered the double shoulder rig adequately, not perfectly, but good enough, he hoped. The four-pack of Beretta magazines, like the Spark six-pack his father carried for his Detonix pistols, would have bulged too much. Michael stripped the magazines from it, leaving the four-pack with his pistol belt and the rest of the gear. He added two 20-round magazines from his backpack. He left the headgear off for a moment longer. He had stuffed his knife, sheath and all, into the waistband of his Levi's, and he drew it out now, using the bootlace-like tie-down on the belt loop to secure it around his left calf beneath the suit. He square-knotted it in place, then knotted over again just to be safe. He remembered his father's advice at all times, to plan ahead. He sealed the suit legs along the inseams of the thighs, then sealed the front of the suit at the top. Finally, he forced the headgear down over his face. He glanced to Hammerschmidt. The German captain was nearly suited up. Michael left his hands out of the suit's attached gloves. With his bare hands, he started plowing sand, digging as shallow a grave as necessary to cover the body from casual view. Overhead, the cylinder was lowering into position. He would be expected on the catwalk. Soon, all eyes would be on the truck. At any moment, the missing men would be discovered. Michael rolled the body into the grave, then shoved and pushed sand over the body. He pulled the hazmat hood over his head.
Good enough.
Michael jumped to his feet and started running to the catwalk. No time to climb the ladder-like steps at the side. Slipping his hands into the suit's gloves, he saw Hammerschmidt behind him. The men on the opposite side of the catwalk were taking long-handled, massive hooks and reached upward and outward to the cylinder. Michael took up one of the metal hooks from the rack beside the catwalk and did the same, carefully guiding the cylinder to its berth.
Out part of that! Easy!
Behind him was Vladimir Karamazov, close enough to kill.
Not yet.
He connected his hook to the cylinder, so did Hammerschmidt. Michael stole a glance behind him. Karamazov, in decontamination gear, was moving away. The cylinder was nearly in place.
Keep coming! War!
Michael watched for Hammerschmidt to react from the corner of his left eye, but his peripheral vision was cut by the suit's face mask. The cable slackened. The cylinder was down. Michael turned to Hammerschmidt as though elated.
We're in deep shit now.
John Rourke lost his balance, regained it, and jumped, keeping the Steyr high, the scope covers back in place, protecting it against impact. He rolled over the snow and skidded to a stop. The M16 across his back impacted his spine.
Ah, shit!
Ahead, he could see the snowshoe tracks of Natalia and the bark shoe prints of Jay. He started running again. Soon, helicopters would be airborne. He glanced behind him. Nothing, yet. His mind raced faster than his legs.
Why would Karamazov? Damn.
There was only one reason he could fathom, and it fit Karamazov's personality. Fit the whole idea of the construction of the womb that Karamazov initiated and Rozhdestvenskaya, Karamazov's successor in KGB, when it was thought Vladimir Karamazov was dead, had continued. Rourke quickened his pace. He looked back again. An armored snow tractor, but the armor would be light to prevent its getting bogged down in drifts. He scanned to right and left, rocks to the left. He veered off at an oblique angle, starting for them. The snow tractor was almost on top of him. There was a turret atop the vehicle with a machine gun. The snow rose up in waves around him, but there was no sense in shooting back. The rocks were less than 50 yards away. John Rourke reached into his right exterior pocket. He had planned ahead. He pulled one of the German high-explosive grenades from his backpack. He bared his teeth and bit down hard on the ring for the pin. His left fist held the rifle. His right fist held the grenade spoon tight against the body. He jumped and wheeled, lobbing the grenade more like a bowling ball than a baseball, which better matched its size. Rourke hurled himself to the snow. The left tread of the snow tractor started to veer right. The snow along the rock face showered over him. He pushed himself to his feet. The snow tractor was overturned. He slung the SSG across his back. He had no time to grab for the M16. Instead, his left hand worked the fasteners at the front of his parka. He brought his right hand to his mouth, biting away the overglove he had replaced after firing the Steyr counter-sniper rifle. His right hand flashed under his jacket and the little Detonix 45 under his left armpit, as his left hand flashed between his knees so he could tear away the other glove. He shifted the pistol into his left hand. He then found the butt of the Python at his right hip. His right fist closed on the Packmeyer-gripped butt of the metalifed and magna-ported Python as it cleared leather. Rourke shuffled left around the nearly inverted top hatch of the snow tractor, giving him clearance for the shots. A soldier, an Animov 60 assault rifle in both fists, showed himself. The man's body collapsed, half hanging out of the turret, but was then suddenly thrust clear. Rourke threw himself to the snow as another man popped out behind his dead comrade with an assault rifle. Rourke rolled onto his back, aiming the Python overhead toward the turret, by feel only. The sight's useless to him this way. He rolled to his stomach, the revolver and the self-loader thrust ahead of him, and he got to his feet. Rourke glanced to right and left, then advanced on the snow tractor. There was no more movement. He judged it likely there were only two men, but he had grenades to waste. He shifted his left thumb behind the Detonix minigun's tang and upped the safety, then shoved the pistol under his right armpit. He then took the grenade from his left pocket. He pulled the grenade pin and carefully tossed the grenade through the hatch. He grabbed his pistol quickly and then ran a few yards back, throwing himself down. Much of the undercarriage of the snow tractor blew outward in jagged, teeth-like shapes. He pushed himself up to his feet, stuffing the little Detonix 45 into his left outside pocket. Rourke scanned the ground. He started back toward his gloves. Mentally, he noted to check the Steyr for damage from the rolls he took with it on his back. But it was a sturdy weapon. If anything sustained trauma, it would be the scope.
He could shoot the SSG nearly as well with the iron sights anyway. With both gloves in his left hand, he started back toward his original path. The choppers would be coming very quickly now, and he still had to catch up with Natalia and Jay. He kept the Python, four rounds still in the cylinder, tight in his right fist as he moved ahead. Maria sat with her knees tight together, the jalaba folded over her legs, her hands folded in her lap, despite the jostling of the SM-4 across the desert. The attack had been canceled. Captain Hammerschmidt gave specific orders to Sergeant Decker, and she didn't know anything specific about them, but the attack was canceled, and Michael Rourke and Otto Hammerschmidt vanished, promising further radio contact. They had substituted themselves for two of the guards on the massive truck that took the canister away across the desert.
Fräulein Doctor! Doubtlessly, her captain will activate the tracking device in his radio, and we will know where they are. This is will lead us perhaps to the Soviet underground city. The Herr Captain and the young Herr Rourke, too. I think they are good soldiers, Fräulein.
Maria was letting her body sway with the rhythm of the vehicle. She realized that she was falling in love with someone who couldn't return her love. And if time were, as it was put in books, to heal his wounds, would there be time enough? She pushed the coarse wool shawl down from her head, running her splayed fingers back through her hair, letting the desert wind catch it. She removed her glasses and closed her eyes, telling herself that the stinging in her eyes was the stinging of the wind only. There were more men in decontamination suits waiting at the desert airfield. The truck drove directly up the ramp of the huge airlifter and the hatchway sealed. Michael felt in the pit of his stomach, as the aircraft left the ground, the sensation of movement and the sensation of being close to death. Hammerschmidt turned to Michael as they drifted into seats on long benches flanking the truck on either side. He kept his arms by his sides to cover the telltale bulges of his pistols beneath the decontamination suit. When he thought no one was looking, he glanced at his Rolex, not too often, but often enough to figure the duration of the trip. He was assessing possibilities. There were 16 other men aboard the craft. Some of them could have been women, but it was hard to tell with the decontamination suits. Plus the air crew in the sealed compartment forward, perhaps some security personnel as well. In theory, at least, it was possible to kill all the others in the decontamination suits without reloading his pistols, giving two shots each. In theory, Hammerschmidt's training would enable him to land the massive aircraft. But where? He had no theory as to the contents of the canister. The decontamination suits could have been a safety precaution alone, or potential necessity. His father told him once to never make a plan and then throw yourself into it just because there was nothing else to do.
The key to a successful plan in life, in combat, in a survival situation, even in a fistfight, is knowledge of the situation. As full and complete knowledge as you can ascertain. Once you have the knowledge to formulate your plan, act upon it. In the meantime, hang back, keep out of range or out of trouble or whatever. Patience is much more than a virtue. It's a necessity.
It was pleasantly comfortable inside the decontamination suit, but Michael was perspiring. Annie Rubenstein stared at the helicopter 200 yards from the tent through the plastic window, but the snowstorm's ferocity was not nearly so intense that they could not have gone on. But there was no way to find her father and Natalia and Captain Hartmann. Their group was inserted deep into Soviet territory, and the helicopters, or whatever brought them, left, awaiting recall by radio. There had been no radio transmission. There was no way to locate them.
Oh, shit!
She thrust her hands into the pockets of her skirt and turned back to face the interior of the tent, to face her husband. Paul played poker for cartridges with the German pilot who brought them here, and the lieutenant who oversaw the forward base. The other half-dozen personnel and the other pilots slept through the storm, only a radio officer and the perimeter guards otherwise awake. She looked back through the tent window to the helicopters and fighter planes further out from the tent. She could see the radar masts when the snow cleared for an instant, see the radar dishes searching the skies. The skies were gray. They arrived and were informed there was still no word from Hartmann, and they would have to wait here. Paul had changed out of his Arctic gear, and she had changed out of the pants she wore beneath hers. Paul laughed at seeing her in pants.
She realized it was the first time he had ever seen her in pants. She wore them so infrequently. Annie began to move about the tent. The living quarters, given over to her and her new husband, Paul, were at the far end of the circus-sized tent. She debated going there so she might get some rest, but she couldn't rest. It was impossible to consider the tent as a conventional structure. It was a one-piece and totally sealed structure with an airlock entryway, completely climate-controlled. She was almost too warm with the sweater she wore across her shoulders. She played poker for a while and won, but when Paul realized why, he warned her against what she was doing. But she couldn't help it. She was nervous. She folded her hand and got up to go stare out the window. At times of heightened stress, Annie's peculiar mental abilities were also heightened. Without trying to, in fact, trying consciously not to, she was reading everyone's hand at the table. She won almost 500 rounds of the German caseless assault rifle ammunition. The ammunition was only a means of keeping score, but she supposed it was cheating anyway. No, Annie couldn't go back to the poker game. She sat on a folding camp chair along the far wall of the tent, away from the poker game, her bag beside the chair from when she first left their living quarters. She opened the bag and took out her embroidery. She checked the tightness of the hoop, then smoothed the material within the circumference of the hoop and examined the design. It was based on one of her mother's paintings that had been used to illustrate the children's books her mother Sarah wrote before the night of the war. It was a tiger. His eyes gleamed as he sat quietly and protective beside a lop-eared rabbit. The rabbit almost vanished between his massive front paws. Annie dozed on the helicopter flight from Iceland to here, and she dreamed, this time of Michael. She asked the radio officer if Michael could be contacted, but learned again that strict radio silence was the safest course of action. The interior of the airlock doorway from the outside opened, and the radio officer entered the room. Paul stood, throwing his cards face down on the camp table.
We have just had a short radio message in code from our troops in Egypt, Frau Rubinstein. Herr Rubinstein. It appears the young Herr Rourke and Captain Hammerschmidt have hidden themselves among a Soviet unit and are at this moment somewhere en route to the Soviet underground city.
Annie dropped the embroidery hoop to her lap, both her hands going to her mouth. In her dream, Michael and Karamazov had been so close they could almost touch, and somehow Michael was in terrible danger. Vladimir Karamazov paced the fuselage of his private jet, eyeing Nikolai Antonovich's decoded message. Karamazov looked at Ivan Krakowski.
You wish to know the contents of your rival's message?
Comrade Marshal, I never considered
never
him a rival.
Never considered him a rival for your colonelcy? He is a better officer, a better leader, a more sensitive person than you. This is why he is not your rival. Why he is holding a small force in waiting to attack the Eden Project, and why you are here with me. For my purpose, you are the better man. And my purposes are all that concern me, Ivan.
It was the first time he had ever called Krakowski by anything other than his last name or his rank, and he watched Krakowski's face. The significance was not lost on the junior officer. Krakowski stood.
Comrade Marshal, I...
Krakowski was very military, his uniform footgear polished to mirror brightness, the creases in his BDU trousers and jacket seemingly razor sharp. Karamazov found himself smiling. No doubt, the bore of his pistol was spotless as well.
Sit down, my friend, and I shall tell you many things.
Krakowski almost sagged into his seat. Karamazov peered out the window. There was an open ocean beneath the aircraft now, wisps of white cloud beneath them as well. He turned his eyes, squinting away from the sunlight and to the message in his hands.
Antonovich tells us that the Eden Project base has been reinforced by several hundred German troops. German troops with tanks and other heavy equipment, and large numbers of helicopter gunships. I find all of this excellent. I have succeeded in dividing my enemy's forces. Iceland, Georgia, Argentina, and, as we learned during that useless little attack they made at the site of the Great Pyramid, in Egypt as well. Meanwhile, the Politburo believes our troops are equally divided, massing for an attack on the new German base outside Mount Hekla in Iceland. massing for an attack against the German headquarters in Argentina. In reality, Antonovich's small force in Georgia and his few spies outside the German-Argentinian headquarters represent the smallest fragment of my army. Our purpose in Egypt has been achieved.
Karamazov stared out the window again, lowering his frame to see at level with the mighty cargo lifter that carried the precious cargo he invaded Egypt to obtain. Surrounding the cargo craft and his own jet were other cargo lifters, helicopter gunships, tanks, other equipment and personnel inside them.
So, we no longer have forces in Egypt. At last report, our staging base outside the underground city has not yet been detected. Were it to be detected even at this moment, it would be too late. The power is now mine, and I shall need a man who is possessed of as little scruple as I am to assist me in my endeavors. That, Ivan Vasilievich Krakowski, is why you are with me now. See that you stay with me, and your future will be assured. Even I cannot rule an entire planet unaided.
Comrade Marshal, the canister extracted from the sand there beside the temple. What does it contain?
The world 5 centuries ago was a place, Ivan. A place you cannot imagine. At least to me. Everywhere, there were seeds of revolution. The leadership of the party was falling into the decadence they themselves decried. And yet the millions flocked to communism, Ivan. I realized that through communism, I could achieve greater ends than any man had achieved before. Through my agents carefully structuring the intelligence data presented to the Kremlin leadership, I was able to advance the cause of war, bring World War III closer and closer. Then it came. My dream. My opportunity, Ivan. And I prepared for every eventuality. With my planning for the womb, which Rozdestvenskaya let slip through his fingers, with my involvement with the underground city, and with the canister that so intrigues you. Tell me, what do you think it contains?
Nerve gas, Comrade Marshal. Perhaps that.
No. More deadly. And I shall use it to make myself the master of all that...
He gestured expansively toward the world beyond the windows of his private aircraft. They hid under rock and overhangs. Jay knew the territory well. After many hours, Natalia sleeping fitfully, Rourke still not allowing himself the luxury, the skies cleared of helicopter gunships, and again they pressed on through the snow, the sun declining rapidly now. Hartman must be notified, but first, locate the underground city, complete the intelligence report. John Rourke remembered the old days, not just before the night of the war, but before he decided his life's work would be survival training and weapons training, the days after he gave up on a career in medicine and joined the Central Intelligence Agency. It was there that he first met Natalia, in a manner of speaking. It was then he learned that intelligence gathering required intuitive knowledge tempered with logic and an understanding of the immediate situation, rather than bare facts alone that could be misleading out of context. With the coordinates of the underground city and the coordinates of the staging area, Hartman would have all the needed data. What to do with it was another question. Conventional saturation bombing was a possibility, a protracted ground war with the Soviet force on their own ground almost predestined for failure. Once they reached Jay's approximate location of the underground city, once Rourke gathered all information he could through observation, then the immediate job would be done. But greater tasks lay before them, individual survival and eventual victory. He would not let Karamazov destroy the world again. He would soon have a grandchild, carried in Madison's womb. Sarah was pregnant, the test she planned to take a formality. He knew it, she knew it. And the other woman he loved, Natalia, there had to be a life for her. His own work had destroyed her life in part. He would not let the rest of it be destroyed. Paul and Annie would have happiness, Madison and Michael, he and Sarah. Then he looked at Natalia, and he realized how very little he did know or could do. In some ways, Natalia and her future was the most important matter in his life, and he was powerless to cause anything but sorrow. Her incredibly blue eyes, the skin so white and soft and beautiful, a heart given to him, and he could not take it, no matter how much he wanted to take it, to touch her. John Thomas Rourke walked on, Natalia beside him, the young man Jay breaking the trail, their path keeping to the shelter of overhanging rocks as well as possible. But where it would lead after that, he didn't know. As they flew, one of the men beside Michael tried on a couple of occasions to talk with him. Michael pretended rudeness, indifference, exhaustion. Eventually, the man stopped talking to him. Michael nodded successfully and did not speak. It was possible that if the man beside him were clever, he would have guessed something was amiss. Michael closed his eyes for an instant, making a mental note that if he got out of this alive, he'd get Natalia to work more with him on vernacular Russian. The aircraft was landing. Michael and Hammerschmidt watched the other technicians from the truck to see what to do next. Shooting their way out once the plane landed would be a futile gesture, but better than surrendering to inevitable death, or worse. The two technicians who worked on the opposite side of the truck stood up wearily and stretched. They then started slowly climbing aboard the vehicle's left side. Michael stood, tapping Hammerschmidt on the shoulder as though awakening him. Together, they then started up to the catwalk. The man who had been seated beside him looked again at Michael.
Yuri?
Michael turned and closed his eyes. In the man's right hand was a wrench from a tool belt the man and some of the others like him wore. The man started for him, up the catwalk, swinging the wrench. Michael twisted around and kicked the man in the chin.
Quiet him!
Hammerschmidt dove upward for the catwalk, but the technicians around him swamped him down. Men in silver-colored decontamination suits swarmed everywhere, over Hammerschmidt and toward the ladder leading to the catwalk. Michael ripped open the front of his decontamination suit, taking one of the Beretta military pistols out of the leather. But he stabbed his right hand with the pistol in it not toward the men in the decontamination suits, but toward the massive canister at the center of the truck. The technicians dropped back, edged as far from Michael and as close to the bulkhead as they could. Hammerschmidt was up.
Good thinking, Michael. Now what?
Hammerschmidt drew his German pistol.
Get those guys forward as near to the cockpit as you can. Anybody steps out of line, shoot the tank here. We've got nothing to lose.
Agreed.
Hammerschmidt gestured with his pistol toward the tank, then gestured the silver-suited men toward the front of the truck and the front of the aircraft. Michael drew his second pistol, aiming it at the men opposite him on the left side of the tank. They climbed down and joined the others. Michael edged forward along the catwalk to the cab of the truck. He could see anxious eyes behind the face masks of the driver and his helper. Michael let himself grin and gestured with one of his pistols toward the canister. With the other pistol, he waved them out of the truck cab. They obeyed. Michael peered through the rear window. Soviet trucks still used key-started ignitions, it was nice to know. And the keys were in the ignition. Michael had been driving a truck since his pre-teens. He thought of Madison. She had been getting pretty good at it. Closed his eyes tight against the tears. No time for them now. He opened his eyes.
I suppose we back the truck out of here as soon as they open the cargo doors and then, as you Americans say, play it by a nose,
It's by ear, but by a nose might turn out appropriate. We'll see.
Michael started climbing down from the catwalk to board the truck cab.
You see, we try to save our asses while we play it by ear in the hope that we'll come in first, at least by a nose. Anatomically, very complicated.
I like you, Michael Rock.
You're not so bad yourself, Otto Hammerschmidt. I'll drive this sucker. You shoot people, okay?
Okay, yes.
I'll shoot a few people too, though. Taught myself how to drive and shoot when I was a kid. When we opened these suits, well, if this canister is leaking at all after 5 centuries in the desert and the stuff inside is half as deadly as I think it is...
We have precipitated our own eventual deaths.
Well put. So, no sense farting around with these damn decontamination suits, right?
Agreed, Michael.
Hammerschmidt stripped away his headgear.
To death,
How about to beating it? Let's get the wheel chocks out of the way.
The aircraft was at full stop. Michael's mind raced to familiarize himself with the truck's dashboard, oil pressure gauges, oil temperature gauges, monitors for the shock absorption systems. The cargo doors were opening.
They won't be too eager to shoot at us with this canister if we can keep it between us and them.
Agreed.
Hammerschmidt nodded, his pistol in both fists, his body crouched between the front seat and the firewall. The windows of the vehicle on both sides were rolled down.
But I wish I had more than this to shoot at them with.
Michael only nodded, ripping one of the Berettas from the leather, sliding it under his right thigh, butt out, ready for his right hand. The vehicle had a manual transmission, he gathered, as a concession to the heavy nature of the load it had been designed for and the terrain it was intended to successfully navigate. Michael found reverse.
The cargo doors are opening, Michael!
Michael tried to get the feel of the truck's pulse, his left hand poised on the emergency brake release, his eyes straining into the mirror for the moment the cargo doors would be fully opened and the ramp dropped.
Nearly open, Michael!
We're gone!
Michael popped the emergency brake release, and he stomped the gas pedal and let up on the clutch. The truck lurched, starting rearward, but painfully slowly.
Don't! Do not let him get away!
Michael looked forward for an instant. One of the decontamination-suited technicians was jumping for the driver's side door. Michael looked at the technician through the open window. The technician fell to the deck. The interior of his mask was smudged with blood over the nose.
It's open!
Michael put the pedal to the floorboard, the truck moving a little faster now. His left fist locked on the top of the wheel, his right fist on the gear shift. The light here gray, darkening, his face and hands already feeling the cold of the air temperature. Armed men wearing decontamination suits were running up the ramp, but Hammerschmidt aimed his pistol out the window. Two of the silver-suited armed men were down, but more were running aboard the truck trailer.
Shoot over the top of the canister, then aim your pistol at the canister and keep as low as you can.
Right!
There was no answering fire from the guards swarming over the truck trailer. The vehicle was halfway down the ramp. A cold wind whipped a fine spray of snow across the air. In the rear window of the cab, Michael could see the armed guards falling back now, climbing down from the trailer and the canister it carried. Of what, he wondered, and running as though terrified. The trailer started to jackknife on the ramp. Michael cut in the brake, worked the transmission into first, and took the cab forward again. Some of the silver-suited technicians bunched back now. The rear end started straightening, and Michael hauled into reverse again, locking the wheel as he stomped the gas pedal. He shot a glance at Hammerschmidt. The German commando was still aiming his pistol at the massive canister behind them. The ramp leading to the rear of the cargo plane began to lift. Michael could just barely see that the rear end of the massive vehicle was onto the ramp. The weight of the machine started pulling back, but he kept his foot hard on the gas pedal. The truck was on the edge of being out of control, but he fought the wheel, keeping onto the ramp. A man in full decontamination suit and battle gear cast his rifle aside and lurched toward the hood of the truck as Michael reversed past him. Michael stabbed his Beretta through the window. The body rocked back, slamming against the fuselage, then toppling over the side of the ramp. He used the safety to drop the hammer, but still held the weapon in his right fist. His hand was large enough to work the knob on the floor-mounted stick.
Michael, they're forming up a circle around us!
Keep your pistol aimed at the cylinder and hang on!
Michael wrenched the wheel, but prematurely, the truck cab's front wheels still partially on the ramp. Michael fought the wheel, still grasping his pistol. The truck cab nearly overturned. The cab seemed to rock on the left wheels, then righted itself. Michael stomped the gas pedal again, not caring now if the rear end jackknifed. The more unpredictable his driving, the more disorganized his Russian opposition would be. He raked the wheel hard right, then hard left, the rear end fishtailing side to side across the snow, the left side of the trailer nearly impacting the ramp leading back into the cargo lifter. He held the Beretta between his thumb and first finger. The last three fingers of his right hand found the shift knob. Michael hammered the brake with the heel of his right foot, his toes smashing down the accelerator as his left foot stomped the clutch. The cab seemed airborne for an instant, the trailer swaying side to side, rocking on its suspension. He slammed the transmission into first as his foot eased the gas pressure, then stomped the gas almost to the floor. In the rear view, across the length of the canister, he could see men running, rifles at high port, looking like moon men from a science fiction novel more than living Russian soldiers in silver decontamination suits. There were troops without decontamination gear, but they were hanging back. Michael's left foot found the clutch and he depressed the gas full to the floor, double-clutching as he upshifted. In seconds, the truck was still sluggish, but moved faster at least. Behind it, visible in the rear view, great breakers of snow plowed upward on either side and behind him. The decontamination-suited men were still running after them. Michael stabbed the Beretta out the window, careful to keep his line of fire at a tangent to the metal cylinder they hauled. He hoped to hold them back. Some fell back, but most of the Soviet personnel kept running after the truck. Michael's heart went into his mouth, but Hammerschmidt hadn't shot into the cylinder. Instead, he killed a man climbing up the right side trailer catwalk. The truck started to gather momentum now. The Jeep vehicle, dead in front of them, skidded to a stop. The decontamination-suited driver and a second man jumped from it, running for their lives. There was no time to swerve away from the vehicle.
Watch out!
He double-clutched down into second. The nose of the truck cab impacted the vehicle. Michael upshifted past the total view. Fireball belched skyward, black and orange, the heat searing for an instant against the bare flesh of his left hand and the left side of his face. He hoped it didn't affect the canister. APCs were starting to move, more of the Jeeps and two motorcycles starting in pursuit. For the first time, Michael took an instant to assess their surroundings.
Subarctic, snowy, mountainous, trees in the distance.
But nothing that looked like an entrance to an underground city of any sort, let alone the underground city of Soviet leadership. Motorcycles came on fast, nearly even with the trailer, as Michael cut the wheel left, aiming toward the mouth of the valley ahead of him.
Shit! Pray that they were able to monitor that tracking signal on the radio set.
Michael looked behind them. The motorcycles, one man on each machine, had to be dead even with the trailer, hugging the sides. He could barely make out the man on the right. The one on the left reached up for the catwalk. He would jump for the canister.
Otto!
Hammerschmidt leaned out the cab window, then tucked back.
I cannot shoot! The one on the side is too close to the canister!
Michael reached to his left cab, grabbing the handle of the Life Support System 2 knife. He drew the blade from the sheath.
Here, and hang on to it! I can't replace it!
I'll try!
Blade in hand, Hammerschmidt was gone, swinging out onto the running board. Michael glanced back. He could see Hammerschmidt between the cab and the trailer. Hammerschmidt leapt down to the catwalk and grabbed the handrail running the length of the canister. He used the knife to hack at the fingers of the man trying to grab for the catwalk. The motorcycle and rider disappeared in a bloody spray of snow. The man on the left was on the catwalk. His motorcycle spun out into the snow. The man edged forward. There was a blur in the rearview mirror. Hammerschmidt, the German captain of commandos, scrambled between the canister and truck cab to tackle the Soviet, driving the man down to the catwalk. The knife flashed in the dying sun for an instant. It then drove downward. It seemed like less than a second later, and the body of the man in the decontamination suit was launched from the catwalk and into the air. Hammerschmidt waved that he was all right. They were on a comparative straightaway now. Michael mentally translated kilometers into miles, realizing that the speedometer was telling him the truck was flat out on a level straightaway and at a little less than 60. The APCs seemed to be bettering his speed from a distance. They were closing. He had no idea where they would go, how they would evade the Russians, if they could evade the Russians. His mind raced as the truck raced, wondering where he could hide a vehicle this size if they even got the chance. He was freezing cold, one level somewhere inside of him afraid, but too preoccupied with staying alive to let the fear concern him. Michael Rourke kept driving.